From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Merry Christmas. On this holiday edition of Fresh Air, we're going back into our archives to bring you some interviews from our past. And that's why we can spend Christmas with Reverend Al Green, the great soul and gospel singer. He'll talk about his life before and after he was born again. We also go back to an interview with Saturday Night Live's Mike Myers, recorded when he was their newest cast member, before he made the hit movie Wayne's World. And rock historian Ed Ward plays the Beatles' Christmas messages from the 60s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh says that President Bush is now the subject of the Iran-Contra investigation. Yesterday, Mr. Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and five others connected with the Arms for Hostages deal. Walsh accused the president of misconduct in his pardons. He was asked by ABC's Nightline if he could revive the charges against Weinberger and the others. Walsh says yes, especially if someone has lied under oath.
The statute of limitations has run out on the substantive crime, on the cover-up itself. The statute of limitations can always be revived by a false statement under oath.
Walsh says the pardons show that powerful people can commit serious crimes in high office without consequence, especially if they have powerful allies. For the second time in a week, Cincinnati protesters toppled a cross erected by the Ku Klux Klan in downtown Fountain Square. The cross, however, was re-erected by the KKK. Police say two men toppled the cross this morning. They were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. Officers say a third man was arrested on similar charges after he tried to damage the fallen cross. Thousands of people are gathering in Berlin today in a candlelight demonstration to protest the spate of attacks against foreigners throughout Germany. Oliver Rehlinger reports for the BBC from Berlin.
If it is completed, the chain of people holding burning candles to demonstrate against racist violence in Germany will be almost 10 kilometers long, stretching from a square in the western part of Berlin to the heart of the east, where last month more than 300,000 people had gathered for the biggest demonstration against xenophobia the city has ever seen. Politicians, trade unions, and churches have called on the people of Berlin to take part in tonight's candlelit human chain, which has for its motto, A Light for Reason and Understanding. Similar processions were held in other German cities over the past few weeks, most spectacularly in Hamburg and Munich, where up to 500,000 people gathered to express their resentment against neo-Nazis and xenophobia.
Oliver Rehlinger reporting for the BBC. U.S. Marines and French Foreign Legionnaires have seized another Somali town today. The troops secured Odour at dawn, making it the sixth key aid distribution center to be protected from armed bandits. United Nations officials are drafting plans to take over the job of moving food to the populace and putting the chaotic country back together. Officials say no timetable, however, has been set. A Marine spokesman says today's main task is to clear mines from around Odour and prepare the airstrip so relief flights can come in. About 5,000 mines have been found on roads and paths around the town, which is 200 miles northwest of Mogadishu. This is NPR. The president of the relief group CARE says that after feeding the starving in Somalia, his group hopes to set up a food distribution system that doesn't threaten the country's existing farmers. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
CARE President Philip Johnston says his group is setting up a program to monitor food produced by Somali farmers so it knows what is being grown, where it's being grown, and in what volume. He says CARE is also arranging to buy some of this Somali-grown food at guaranteed prices to ensure that relief efforts don't interfere with normal planting patterns.
It is quite possible to have a free food distribution program which will be a disincentive to Somali farmers who have planted their crops, grown their crops, and then no market exists in which to sell their crop.
Johnston says relief agencies will also help farmers clear out and repair failing irrigation systems and supply cattle to encourage some Somalis to return to herding. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Japanese Prime Minister Kiichi Miyazawa reportedly said that he expects the Clinton administration to blow a lot of hot air on U.S.-Japanese trade relations. Kyoto News Service says the prime minister made that remark while he was taping an interview that will be aired on January 2nd. Miyazawa apparently said the new administration will probably say all sorts of things, but that's natural when a new government comes in. The prime minister says he expects things to quiet down after a few months. Japan has a $43 million trade surplus with the United States. The surplus is expected to grow this year as Japanese firms try to make up for a recession at home by stepping up exports. Indian police arrested more than 3,000 Hindu devotees today who were threatening to march to a shrine in the northern town of Ayodhya. The shrine is the site of a mosque that was destroyed by Hindu militants earlier this month, touching off countrywide religious rioting. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas. For the holiday, we've gone into the Fresh Air archives and brought out an interview with the great soul and gospel singer Al Green. His ballads of the 70s were about as great as soul singing gets, but now when he sings about love, it's his love for a higher being. After becoming rich and famous with such hits as Tired of Being Alone and Let's Stay Together, Green was born again. In 1976, he was ordained and became the pastor of the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Memphis. By the end of the decade, he had virtually given up performing secular music and sang only gospel.
I'm too close to heaven. I can almost see my journey's end. Oh, I'm too close. To shaking hands with all my friends. You know I'm a too close. Oh, I can't
I spoke with Al Green in 1991 before a concert in Philadelphia. I asked him if he felt it was inappropriate for him to sing secular songs.
Well, I'm opening the show with L-O-V-E Love. Yeah, right. I'm opening the show with L-O-V-E Love. So we're going to go from there. I was doing a show the other week in Jackson, Mississippi on Capitol Street down in Jackson, Mississippi, and I must have lost my mind. Went crazy or something. I sung Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Really?
By Otis Redding. So they said, Reverend Green is singing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Man, he is cool, man. So we just kept singing and having fun. I think if you sing songs that bring people together and magnify love instead of hatred, I think you might do okay.
Are there songs of yours that you won't sing now?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Well, I can't sing some songs because I wrote them because of I Love You, Baby, Darling, I Care for You. You know, I wrote them because of sensual love. I want to take you in my arms and sweep you off my feet, put you on a plane, go to a nice resort area with a cold bottle of champagne and kiss you. Mwah, 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 mwah. I wrote them because of that. And then, but now like Let's Stay Together, I wrote for couples because whether times are good or bad, happy or sad, whether we're right or wrong, forgiveness is in there. And we can always make up. That's always a lot of fun. And we can go on with our lives being what we're supposed to be.
Now, how do you feel when you hear your sensual secular songs on the radio?
I feel kind of funny, and then I kind of blush, you know, because I've spent so much time under the book now. And so when I hear some of those songs, I kind of blush, you know, and I go, did I actually say that? You know, here I am, come and take me. Well, I did it because of I was so flamboyant, and I was so, kind of had an air of arrogancy, you know. And I sung it because here I am, come and take me. You understand? And you know how that is. And so I learned to be more humble, more giving, more loving, and more understanding, you know, in that, yeah. So it's a little different, but still strong.
Well, Al Green, I'm going to play Let's Stay Together.
Let's play that.
That's something you still sing, right?
I'm singing that tomorrow night.
Okay, here we go. My guest Al Green and his hit recording of Let's Stay Together. Do you remember how you met Willie Mitchell, who was the person who signed you to High Records and produced all the hits that you had with High?
Yeah, I remember how I met him.
How'd you meet him?
I met him in the country out in Midland, Texas, in Odessa, Texas, out there. I met him out there. And, he asked me about going to Memphis to sing on a recording because he worked at a studio. And we were riding in the car that day, and I said, how long do you think it'll take me? I was so flamboyant. I don't understand how I did it. I was riding with this guy, and I says, how long will it take me to become a star? He says, and he swallowed like a choke, right? He says, a star? Well, about 2 years probably if you really work at it. I said, excuse me, let me out. I don't have any kind of time. He says, you're not serious. I said, I'm serious. I don't have 2 years to waste on practicing to become a star. I need some money now. And really, so he took me down to High. He says, this kid's going to be phenomenal. They says, how do you know that? He says, because he's got it in him. And so he borrowed $1,500 for me from the president of the company to get me a place to stay and all that, and says, I want to work with him because he's going to be phenomenal. Just watch.
Gee, it really pays to have chutzpah, huh?
I guess I just told him I wanted to be what I wanted to be.
Now the first song that he asked you to record was a cover of the Beatles' "I Want to Hold Your Hand," right?
Would you believe that?
It really is hard to believe. Why did he choose that?
I have no idea.
What was your reaction to it?
My reaction was good. I thought it was a great song. It was a wonderful song, but it was for the Beatles. I sung I Want to Hold Your Hand. I sung Driving Wheel. We was trying to find Al Green. That's what we was trying to find. Who is this guy? Who is this guy with the high falsetto and the rough voice? And Willie says, I tell you what, don't sing with a rough voice. I said, well, what do you want me to do? We was cutting all these different songs about different people, just a lot of songs. He says, sing mellow. Don't sing hard. Sing mellow. And I just went out there and started singing, I'm so tired of being alone. And I'm so tired of on my own. help me, girl, as soon as you can. And I looked in the studio mirror. They have this glass, right? And you're looking at the engineers. Yeah. And everybody was jumping up and jumping up and jumping up. And I says, well, I must be doing something right. So I just keep on saying, people say. And that's, I don't know how that started. That's the way it started.
Well, that was your song. It was a song you wrote. So you already had it written.
Yeah, after we got done cutting all these other people's songs, the Beatles and, and all these blues songs and the Temptations, I Can't Get Next to You and all these songs, I says, I got a song too. So Willie says, oh, please. Because he'd been cutting all day. We'd been cutting all day. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I says, I got me a song and I wrote it on my own. So Willie told one of the guys, go out there and see what he got, would you please? I got to have a drink. Willie had a little shot of vodka or something. And after he went to feeling better, he says, all right, what we got out here? And it was this song, Tired of Being Alone. And I worked it up with the band. And I sung it and it became our first million seller.
Well, I'm going to play it.
Let's play it. Come on. Let's play it.
This is Al Green's first big hit, a song he wrote, Tired of Being Alone. That's Al Green, my guest today, singing Tired of Being Alone. I want to get back to a story you were telling before we heard that about, you know, how you had to sing the I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah.
It's your first song. How did you sing that? I mean, what voice did you use?
I don't know. I just kind of sang, hey, you got that something that I think I understand. When I feel that something that I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Like that.
That sounds great.
I sung it in 71. That was 19 years ago.
Right. Right. So when you wrote Tired of Being Alone, were you alone? Were you tired of being alone?
Yeah, well, my girlfriend kept leaving me the key and leaving the apartment. And she would leave me a lot, and I says, well, how? It was snowing one night. It was snowing, and I had all the windows open because I was there by myself for hours on end. And I says, well, how can I do something with this? How can I make something out of this? And so I took a pencil and started writing it down because I was angry, and I was writing, I'm tired of being alone. I'm tired of on my own. Then I wrote several other things. I scratched those out, and I said, help me as soon as you can. And then I went to getting serious about it. People say that I found a way to make you say that you love me, which is I don't have to make you. If you really love me, you'd be here with me. And I was writing on that connotation. You didn't go for that. It's a natural fact. That, yeah, like that.
Had you written songs before?
Maybe one song before, that's all.
Oh, so this was something like newly discovered when you were recording this?
Yeah, everything was discovered at that time because we didn't have anything to, to no resources to kind of go back and say, I can do this or that.
Singer and preacher Al Green is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Oh, Lord.
like the bird in the sky. Oh, I can buy anything that money can buy.
Al Green is my guest. One of the records that you made that was a cover of another recording was To Sir With Love.
Yeah.
And this had to be, like, when you saw the movie, you had to think of this as, like, a real corny song, right?
Yeah.
You had such a great version of it. Was it your idea to record the song?
I always wanted to record the song for years.
Why?
And I don't know. I heard this lady sing this song on a movie. Of something, some lady from England, and I heard this song, and I wanted to sing that song, and nobody was interested in letting me sing it. My producer says, come on, you don't want to sing it, sir, with love. They would always figure out a way how to cut me off, you know. Well, let's, everybody break, you know what I mean? So we never cut to Sir With Love. So I says, when I got my own studio, you know, after I came... to the point where I want to sing gospel, everybody in Los Angeles and in L.A. says that's a bad idea. Everybody in Memphis said, oh, God, he's not going to try something else. I said, but I've got to sing gospel. I'm born again, and there's a lot of good that can be done from singing gospel as well. I went to my studio in Memphis, set up a studio, had Bill Cantrell to put it together, and recorded The Lord Will Make a Way and all those Highway to Heaven and all those songs on that same album in a makeshift studio. And that was the pivotal point in the Al Green career of things. But since then, I've come to know Al Green. I've come to know myself better. I've come to know.
So you recorded To Sir With Love during that session?
Mm-hmm. During that time period, during the next two albums there, yeah. I cut it because I want to cut it so bad.
I'm going to play it.
Let's play it.
This is To Sir With Love, sung by my guest, Al Green.
The time has come for closing books and long last looks for sin. Yeah. And as I leave,
Reverend Al Green is my guest. There's a story about you that's kind of legendary in music lore. And I'm thinking of the story of the time a woman you were with poured hot grits or hot oatmeal or something
cream of wheat
on you while you were in the bath and scalded you and then took her life.
Yeah.
She killed herself afterwards. Is there a connection between that story and your being born again?
Nah, not whatsoever. People in journalism like to say that that was the reason, but I was born again in 73. This incident happened in 1974, so it really don't correlate, and they like to have it to be so that it correlates, but it doesn't. I was born again because they saw what I could be, not what I was. They knew what I was. I was a no good, woman hunting, champagne drinking, good time having, Saturday night, blues singing man. But they says, I'm not interested in what you are. What we're interested in is what you can be. And so I was born again on that premise.
How soon after you were born again did you become a minister?
I was born again in 73. I ran for 3 years trying to keep from becoming one, and I started church in December 1976.
So when you became a minister and started a church, did you have the church built? Was it a building that already existed, or did you have it built?
No, I was in a hurry. I went and bought the church. Time I saw it, I says, didn't make no difference what church it was. My mind was in such a turmoil. I was a star. I could go anywhere, people know you. But I was spiritually so turmoil. I was in a suite, in the best suite in the house, a presidential suite in the Holiday Inn, Rivermont, in Memphis, upstairs, praying in the middle of the floor with a preacher. I needed to go and do what I, it was time for me to do what I needed to do. So when I went to the office the next Monday morning, there was a preacher came by. He says, are you Al Green? I said, yeah. He said, I was sent over here to talk to you. I said, by who? So he says, you want to start singing, start preaching? I said, yeah, let's go find a church. We went and looked on the market and found a church. I took out a check out of my pocket right out of here, bought that building. The next Sunday we had church.
So you paid for it from money that you made as a music star.
Right, just like that.
Since you were a star, and you still are a star, but, I mean, when you started the church, people knew you as Al Green, you know, soul singer.
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of people showing up, especially early on?
Yeah.
Just to to hear Al Green
still
sing?
Still do. Yeah.
So how much do you sing in the church?
I sing quite a bit, but I also, when they come, I also drop the bomb. Yeah. That's it.
You don't let them off easy.
No. I catch them with that voice, and I hold them with that voice, and then I tell them what they, and they wind up agreeing with me.
Do a lot of people, including record producers, try to talk you into making secular records again?
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you ever consider it?
They tried to talk me into it the other day, yeah. I consider it.
So tell me, now we're recording this on a Thursday.
Okay.
And the day after we record this, you're going to be performing at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia.
Okay, let's go.
Now, at the Academy of Music, are you gonna be preaching at all to you?
No, I don't preach when I go out to do concerts. When I go to do concerts, you go to do concerts. You go to do revivals, then you preach. When you go to sing, you go to sing. There's some things that make just beautiful sense. Now, I may say some things, but I'm not going to preach. No. You come to do a concert, you do the concert. So we're going to do the concert.
Al Green, it's really been a pleasure to meet and talk with you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, dear.
Our interview with Al Green was recorded in June of 1991. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone. 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah, talking about how she can make it right, yeah. Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah. Oh, baby, love and happiness.
Love
and happiness.
Love and happiness.
Oh,
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mike Myers is one of Saturday Night Live's best-known cast members, thanks to his hit movie Wayne's World. But when we talked to Myers in 1990, he was the newest and youngest member of the group. Coming up as part of our holiday series of interviews from the archives, an interview with Mike Myers. Also, rock historian Ed Ward plays the Beatles' Christmas messages. If you were in their fan club in the 60s, you got a new record each year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Special Rencontre prosecutor Lawrence Walsh says President Bush is now the subject of his investigation. Yesterday, Mr. Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and five other former government officials who were linked to the case. In several television appearances last night, Walsh accused the president of misconduct, saying Mr. Bush has withheld some of his notes on the Iran-Contra affair. The statute of limitations has already run out on cover-up allegations, but Walsh told ABC last night the statute can always be revived by a false statement under oath. An explosive fire in the historic coal mining town of Matewan, West Virginia, destroyed eight businesses today. Seven people were slightly injured. John Warden is the director of the Mingo County Ambulance Service. He says the blaze started in a downtown auto parts store filled with paint, turpentine, and other chemicals.
The Napa store with five others were totally leveled by fire and explosion due to the combustible that exploded. You know, all the fire departments done a magnificent job in controlling this fire, but it was so the heat was so intense. I mean, we lost vehicles. We had approximately seven firemen with injuries. Thankfully, they were only minor injuries, but the damage is running into the millions.
Some of the destroyed buildings dated back to Matewan's founding at the turn of the century. The town is the site of the feud between the Hatfield and McCoy clans. In 1920, 10 people died in a gun battle between coal company-hired detectives and residents after striking miners were evicted from company-owned housing. The movie Matewan was made about that battle. The Israeli cabinet has refused to allow a Red Cross convoy to deliver supplies to 415 expelled Palestinians camped in the no-man's land between Israeli and Lebanese forces in southern Lebanon. The BBC's Alex Brody reports from Jerusalem.
Lebanon had refused to allow supplies through to the 415 Palestinians expelled by Israel into no-man's land, so the International Committee of the Red Cross asked Israel to let its aid convoy get to them by a southern route, the part of South Lebanon controlled by Israel. That request split the Israeli government. So the Prime Minister, Mr. Rabin, called a special cabinet meeting to vote on it, those losing being bound by collective responsibility. The vote was close. Eight votes for refusing permission, Mr. Rabin's position. Six votes with the Foreign Minister, Mr. Rabin's perennial dovish rival, Shimon Peres, for letting the convoy through. Two dovish ministers, Oren Amir and Haim Ramon, abstained.
Alex Brody reporting. The U.S.-led military coalition in Somalia seized the town of Odur today. The multinational forces now control six of eight towns that they have planned to secure. This is NPR News. The commander of the United Nations forces in Bosnia says he has grave reservations about plans to use military force to enforce the no-fly zone over Bosnia. The UN commander says such a plan is likely to jeopardize his relief operation. Bob Simpson filed this report for the BBC from Sarajevo.
General Nambia said he questioned whether UN peacekeeping and humanitarian work could go ahead at the same time as forces operating under the UN flag were using military means to enforce an air exclusion zone over Bosnia-Herzegovina. He added that he was skeptical as to the possibility of such operations running alongside one another. There would be a danger to his troops in the field, he said, let alone to unarmed observers and civilian aid workers. In fact, if humanitarian operations were to continue, they would have to be taken over by the military, according to officials involved. At present, they are civilian-run with the military providing escort. The UN commander in Sarajevo, General Philip Morion, has asked the Bosnian president, Alija Izetbegovic, to institute an inquiry into a mortar attack onto his headquarters. He said three rounds fired from within the city had landed within 10 feet of the building.
Bob Simpson reporting. Former junk bond financier Michael Milken will be transferred to a Los Angeles halfway house January 4th. He spent 22 minutes, or rather months, in federal prison on his conviction of securities law violations. Milken will be allowed to leave the house during the day to work. There is no indication on what job he's likely to take. His old company, Drexel Burnham Lambert, is defunct. He is also barred by the Securities and Exchange Commission from working for or becoming any kind of investment dealer or broker. Several of the nation's retailers are cheering this holiday season. They say it's their first good selling season in 4 years. Sears Roebuck & Company reports its stores ran ahead of their sales plan. Toys R Us says it had strong sales of video games. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For the holidays, we've gone into the Fresh Air archives to find some interviews from the past we thought you'd enjoy. When we talked to Mike Myers in 1990, he was Saturday Night Live's newest cast member and was just gaining attention for his sketch Wayne's World, in which he and Dana Carvey played teenagers with their own community access cable program. Since then, Myers wrote the Wayne's World movie. It made him and Dana Carvey internationally known. Myers is writing a sequel. Besides Wayne Campbell, Myers also developed the character Dieter, the pretentious host of Sprockets, a postmodern show on West German television. When I spoke with Mike Myers, he had just debuted a new character on Saturday Night Live, middle-aged man, a paunchy superhero who dispenses advice and guidance to younger people, like this couple in bed.
This has never happened to me, I swear.
It's all right. It's all right.
I just lost it.
Well, was it me? Did I do it wrong?
No. I don't know what happened.
Maybe I can help.
Who are you?
I'm middle-aged man. Now, what's the trouble?
Well, see, he just had a problem with the, you know...
Will you shut up?
What was it? Too soon or not at all? Just a quip. It could be stress or cheap liquor. Tell me, have you injured yourself by doing any heavy lifting?
Well, I was putting up some aluminum siding.
Aha! You realize that reduces the value of your home.
Really? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. I'm middle-aged man.
You started a new character on the last Saturday Night Live, middle-aged man. Who were you thinking of?
I was thinking of myself, as I always do. That sounds awful. No, I was just, I was doing, there was a scene the week previous called The Award Show, which didn't make it to air, and I had to play Sir Richard Attenborough. So the hair and glasses is for Sir Richard and the teeth, too, is for Sir Richard Attenborough. And last week, on a Friday before the show, I just happened to be changing out of my costume, and I've noticed that since I've gotten on the show, as with everybody who's been on the show, I put on 15 pounds, and I have what we call in Canada a Molson muscle. I'm starting to get a gut. So it was like, oh, no, I'm looking at my gut. And then I just thought of... this is what I'm going to look like when I'm middle-aged. I mean, it's not going to be that terrible. I'm going to know how escrow works. And then that amused me, and I thought, well, that could be a superpower. And then it just went from there.
Let's get to Wayne's World. This is one of your most popular characters. Wayne hosts an access cable TV show in Aurora, Illinois. He's a teenager who's really into heavy metal. Describe the character some more.
Well, Wayne is a compilation or a distillation of everybody I knew growing up in the suburbs of Toronto. It's a sort of adolescent, suburban, heavy metal experience. And so I thought, what if my character Wayne, who I did at Second City in Toronto and Second City in Chicago, had his own cable access show? Hopefully it would be how I was when I was a kid, which is, God, it would be great to have my own show in my basement. And then I'd have anybody I wanted on to be on. And it's completely, it makes no attempts to be universal. It's just totally about his basement and his world.
All right, welcome to Wayne's World. Here's your host, Wayne Campbell.
Party! Woo! Party hardy! Woo! It's Friday, it's 10:30, it's time to party. I'm your excellent host, Wayne Campbell. With me, as always, is Garth.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Okay, before we bring out our first guest,
We'd like to introduce our newest feature. It's called Movie World with Wayne and Garth.
Movie World! Movie World! With Wayne and Garth! Pretty fun! Let's play!
Woo! All right, let's take a look at the movies, all right? The first movie is Back to the Future 2, starring Michael J. Fox. I liked it, Garth.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Okay, let's move on.
Did you ever talk in the kind of teen slang that Wayne is always coming
up
with?
Yeah, I did. I went through a lot of adolescent phases. I went through a heavy metal phase, and then I went to England in 1977 just as punk was big. I went through a punk phase. Then I saw the movie Quadrophenia. Did you ever see that with
The
Who?
Yeah, yep.
And I went through a mod phase. There's a ton of mods in Toronto. It would be like, you know, it'd be mod bars. People would actually go out and buy Vespas and stuff. And then I got hired at Second City. By that time, I just turned 19, so I was out of my adolescent thing. Although when I got hired at Second City, I had really short hair and a long tail down my back.
So do you keep your ears open for teenagers to hear what kind of language is? Because language changes so quickly.
Yeah, it does. But I'm surprised that it doesn't change all that much.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an adolescent accent, which is weird, that people tend to grow out of or socialized out of. And I was surprised at how homogenous to North America it is.
Did you have it?
Yeah, it would be like, I don't know what you mean. Hey, back off. Don't hassle me, man. It would be like that. I really like that guy, you know? And it's strange, too, because people who are in the arts had the same type of accent in Toronto, too. It's just, I really like that painting. I really thought it was great. I like his use of negative space. Do you want a cappuccino? I really like it there.
This is the roots of Dieter, right?
Yes. Well, that's the thing. They're all related. It's all...
Tribe?
It's tribes, you know,
basically. We just found, I couldn't believe that there'd be any kind of link between Wayne and Dieter, but I guess you just...
Well, it was a friend of mine in Toronto who never actually got to be an artist, but did everything around art, like... He was interested in photography, but he ended up painting backgrounds, you know, like the splotches of paint. And he was interested in being a filmmaker, but he got into colorizing and somehow managed to justify colorizing, even though it's sort of impolitic in the art world.
For our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, which features your character, Dieter, would you describe it for us?
Dieter was a young artist from Stuttgart who came to Toronto. He's an actual person.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, and he was a waiter in Toronto, and he would, like, take your order and say, what would you like? And then you would start to talk, and if it was a hot dog or something banal, he would say, your order has become tiresome. I'm going away now. And if his favorite tune came on, it would be like, yes, and would you like hold on, my favorite song? And he would go up and dance. And then you'd wait for hours. But he was fascinated with obscure Americana, like F Troop and hockey cards. He loved hockey. That was our main thing that I thought I could talk to this person. Was he loved hockey, and I thought it was amazing. And he also loved to touch monkeys.
Oh.
And that's actually true, because he took a textures course in Stuttgart, and he had to touch tapioca, styrofoam, and monkeys. And it was that time that I knew that I loved to touch monkeys.
See, for our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, there's always a sequence in Sprockets where he says...
Would you like to touch my monkey?
Yeah, I could never figure out where that was from.
It's just because he took a textures course, and, you know, I love textures. Your eyebrows are bizarre. Can I touch them? You know, he'd say things like that.
Yeah, you have such a great way in that show of intellectualizing everything that's fun or pop or...
With Dieter.
With Dieter, yeah.
Any sort of pretentious or pseudo-pretentious idea I ever had, I can sort of stick it into Dieter, and Dieter can do it. And it's like, it's not me, it's this guy.
That was Vietnam by Schreibmaschine. And now's the time for Rater Record. What is your name?
My name is Gerhard Müller.
My name is Elsa Bauer.
And what gymnasium do you go to?
We go to the Goethe-Gymnasium in Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Your hair is grotesque. What did you think of the song on a scale of 1 to 14?
It was hellish yet exquisite. I give it a 9 out of 14.
I thought it was bourgeois and banal. I give it a negative 3 out of 14, and I thought lyrically it had...
Your story has become tiresome. Sadly, there are no integers on this scale, so your gangly adolescent attempt to be clever has been futile.
Well then, Dieter, what did you think of the song?
It had a good beat, and it was easy to dance to.
I gave it a 14. This next song is called Darwin's Burden by the Obelisks.
So this waiter, Dieter, mm-hmm. upon whom you model the character, does he know that this is an homage to him?
I don't think he does. And well, somebody told me he went back to Germany for a bit. His visa had expired. And then somebody told me he moved to Australia, which makes total sense. So I'm sure it'll get back to him, but he's far too cool to ever call me and say, I understand you are doing me. You know, it would be just too not cool.
My guest is Mike Myers of Saturday Night Live. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Mike Myers is my guest from Saturday Night Live. You did commercials as a kid?
Yeah.
What kinds of commercials?
I used to actually have my resume memorized. It was like Kit Kat, Applejack, Sunlight, PC Hydro, Datsun, Kmart Shoes, Wrigley Spearmint Gum. Just anything where they needed a little redheaded kid. You know, gee, Mom, this is the best. That was me. And then I went through my punk phase, and I couldn't get cast for my life. Because I had really short hair and T-shirts that said Anarchy in the UK. And they wanted, like, a little kid who plays basketball. And I'd be like, yeah, forget it. Basketball's bourgeois. So I stopped doing that.
But so how old were you when you stopped?
My last commercial, I was 17. And I haven't done one since.
Well, that's pretty old, actually.
Yeah.
I just expected you were doing it for baby food or something when you were really young.
No, I started when I was 8. And I did a dancing commercial.
Oh, great.
For
with Datsun. Tap shoes and everything?
No, it was jazz dancing, which is even more a secret. Sort of dancing, solid gold type dancing that nobody really should see. And that's what I was doing.
That's the corniest kind of dancing, the kind of interpretive dancing
no,
on
cornier.
Commercials. Yeah.
No, there's cornier dancing, and that's the reason I got into dancing, was there was a show on Canadian TV called The Pig and Whistle, which was a mock pub show, British pub show
uh-huh.
for... British expatriates who were, like, really homesick. And it was like, come in to the Pig and Whistle, come in and have a laugh. And then they'd had these Cockney, like, Mary Poppins dancers, you know, with the kerchiefs tied around their neck
yeah.
and flat caps and a lot of posing and a lot of knee slapping. Knees up, Mother Brown, knees up, Mother Brown. And I thought, now I was 4, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
You've come a long way, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I've come a long way since The Pig and Whistle.
So that's how you started doing commercials?
Yeah.
The name of the psychotic killer who escapes from the institution in Halloween is Michael Myers.
Yes.
Did you hear about this a lot when when the movie came out?
Yeah, whenever I go to cash a check, it's Michael Myers, the killer. Just don't kill me. Honestly, I'll cash the check. And I have to give them one of those, that's funny, I never get that. Laughs. That's great. I never get that. That's great.
Mike Myers is the co-star of Wayne's World and a cast member of Saturday Night Live. He co-wrote and stars in I Married an Axe Murderer, which is scheduled for release in late spring. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Coming up later on All Things Considered, more on the pardon of Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, by President Bush. We'll hear from Judge Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel, who says the pardon is a sordid affair, but also from Bob Bennett, who is Weinberger's defense lawyer, who says that the sordid matter here is not the pardon, but the conduct of the investigation by Judge Walsh. Also, on this Christmas Day, we'll be hearing from storyteller Bill Harley about young boys and their toys, particularly when those toys are of a military nature. Also, about the attraction between boys and toy guns, coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Christmas is very important in the world of British pop. Singers from Alma Cogan to Tommy Steele to Adam Ant have participated in the year-end pantomime shows. And bands like Jerry and the Pacemakers and Slade have released Christmas singles through the years. But rock historian Ed Ward says no recordings have been as downright odd and revealing as the private ones the Beatles made.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
All my trouble seems so far away. Now it looks as though we're here to stay. I believe in yesterday.
Yes, that really was the Beatles. You might remember the song being rendered with a bit more finesse. Or you might be really lucky and know where that came from. If so, then I know your secret. You were a member of the Beatles fan club, and each year you could look forward to getting the infamous Beatles Christmas record. And if you got them, you probably puzzled over them like all the rest of the fans. What were these guys up to? Well, the early ones weren't so bad. The first one, in 1963, was positively cuddly.
Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen as the slow ray round about, deep and crispy, brightly showed the boot last night on the musty cruel Henry Hall and David Lloyd, Betty Grable too.
Hello, this is John speaking with his voice. We're all very happy to be able to talk to you like this on this little bit of plastic. This record reaches you at the end of a really gear year for us, and it's all due to you. When we made our first record on Parlophone towards the end of 1962, we hoped everybody would like what we'd already been our type of music for several years already. But we had no idea of all the gear things in store for us. It all happened really...
On and on they talked, each thanking the fans for sticking with them. You get the real sense that they were amazed that all of this had happened, despite their putting up the front of arrogant, jaded pop stars. For 5 or so minutes, 4 friends goofed with each other in the studio, but the sincerity was unmistakable. They'd gotten slicker by the time the next year marched around.
Everybody, this is Paul, and I'd just like to thank you all for buying our records during the past year. We know you've been buying them because the sales have been very good, you see. Don't know where we'd be without you, really, though.
In the army, perhaps.
Oh, we hope you've enjoyed listening to the records as much as we've enjoyed melting them. No, that's wrong. Making them.
Once again, they were having fun, reading from somebody's bad hand-rotor, as John calls it, plugging their first movie, cracking up when they deviate from the script. There's sort of a hip distancing that still includes the listener, and since the number of Beatle fans had grown astronomically in the past year, that was a lot of puzzled people. Beatle-peatle, as Paul called them. The 1965 record began with that horrid rendition of Yesterday, and as it progresses, it seems like it might actually have started with a few stiff drinks. By 1966, not even their fans expected them to be warm and cuddly, so what they got was part vaudeville, part enigma.
Everywhere it's Christmas, everywhere it's song. London,
Paris, oh, and New York,
and Tokyo, Hong Kong. Oh, everywhere it's Christmas,
and I'm off to join the char.
Everywhere is Christmas,
at the end of every year.
Oh, everywhere is Christmas, at the end of every year.
Opening with a minute of odd music, the record went on to tell a completely incomprehensible story. Listened to in the right frame of mind, it could elicit a giggle or two, and these sorts of giggles were just what Beatle fans wanted for Christmas. It doesn't take a genius to tell that this next one is from the time when Sgt. Pepper was brewing.
Boys arrive at BBC House.
What do you want?
We have been granted permission, O wise one.
Pass in peace.
Christmas time is here again.
An audition will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday the 1st in the Fluffy rehearsal rooms. Bring your own.
Once again, an incomprehensible story, but of course they're using studio tricks to tell it. I hope the fans enjoyed it, because it's the last one that was any fun at all. The 1968 one was patched together. George was in New York, and the record featured a cameo appearance by a person with a Christmassy name, Tiny Tim. Not the kind of Christmas party I'd want to be invited to, but then these were grim times for the band. They got worse, of course, as the last in the series makes clear.
Happy Christmas.
I see that you're strolling in Ascot Garden with your wife, Yoko, but, do you have any special thoughts for Christmas?
Well, Yoko, it is Christmas, and my special thoughts, of course, turn towards eating.
All right, so eating. Well, what do you like to eat?
Well, I'd like some cornflakes prepared by Parisian hands.
Each Beatle recorded his own message. Ringo plugged his film, The Magic Christian, and an engineer pasted it all together. What had started as a sincere thank you had ended as a self-indulgent raspberry, but that was okay. By the time the Beatles broke up, people were too cool for fan clubs, too cool for Christmas. Aren't you glad that time has passed?
This is George Harrison saying, happy Christmas, Christmas, Christmas.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin, research assistants from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas, me. You sure did treat me nice. Well, Merry, Merry Christmas, baby. Yes, you sure did treat me nice. Well, gave me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with choreographer and dancer Twyla Tharp. And we check back with Red Cross spokesperson Ann Stingle. She's just returned from Somalia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.